All right, so picking back up in Exodus 13, we have a lot to cover. We can do it. All right, so we see Exodus kind of like continuing to start to go out of the land. Okay, and we see the Lord leading his people, right? The Lord leads Israel. It says that he did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, right? Because if you're looking just on a map of kind of the most direct route from Egypt to like the land of Canaan, okay, where they're going, the promised land, it would be kind of you go up and just along the coast, right? That'd be the easiest, shortest. But we have kind of the Philistines are there, and the Lord's like, let's not go that way because they're going to turn back, right, when they see war and all that stuff, okay? They're going to change their minds. And so instead, he leads them toward what our translations say, the Red Sea, all right? Literally, that phrase is the Reed Sea, all right? Or like the Sea of Reeds is kind of a better translation of that, okay? And so there's a lot of different proposals of what that could be, right? Some take the actual Red Sea, right? That kind of Gulf of the Suez Gulf, I think it's called, all right? Or the Gulf of Aqaba. And then another option that I tend to lean a little bit more towards, all right, is there's these what are called like the Bitter Lakes, all right, that are kind of just north of the Red Sea, okay? They are large lakes, and potentially that is kind of a good, I've heard some people claim that's a good spot for the crossing, okay? And just because it's a lake doesn't mean it's any less like impressive, right? Or different things, right? You could think of some like the Sea of Galilee, right, in Israel. We call it a sea, but in reality, like it's like a lake, okay? But it's big, okay? And even these lakes, they're big. They aren't just like, oh yeah, just like walk around a little bit. It's like, no, like it's still going to take, you could technically, I guess, but it's going to take a long time. And so where they're encamped, all right, it's still in a position where they would be considered to be somewhat trapped, right? That there's no easy, quick way, especially when you're moving over 600,000 people. You're not going to move quick, okay? With all your livestock and kids, not going to be quick, okay? And so that is kind of where I would lean towards with that, okay? And so we see then chapter 14 come to that. In chapter 14, where they, again, they're kind of trapped in a sense, right? And essentially, this is almost kind of like the Lord is like taunting Pharaoh into like, come on, one last showdown, right? They're trapped. You got your army. Go for it, right? Kind of a thing. And we see it works, right? Pharaoh hears they're trapped, kind of a thing. And what? He gets his army together and pursues them, all right? And as they get close, right? You guys remember the reaction of the Israelites when they start to see Pharaoh's army coming?
Freak out.
Yeah, they kind of freak out. They're like, why'd you bring us out here to just die out here, right? You should have just left us in Egypt, kind of all that stuff, right? And that begins to show, right? Did they really believe in the Lord? No, right? It starts to show they have a problem, right? That Israel has a problem. There's a vertical relationship problem between them and God, right? That we're going to keep kind of seeing throughout Exodus, but we start to see that here. They don't fully believe, right? And so they cry out, but then notice Moses' response to the people, right? Tells them to fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord. And specifically in verse 14, what's he say? The Lord will fight for you, right? Do you guys remember what name means God will fight for you or the Lord fights for you?
Israel.
Yeah, Israel, right? The name Israel, right, means God fights for you. So essentially, what that was established back in Genesis, remember, right? That God fights for his people, he fights for you. And what? Now that's happening again, right? And it's on the more national scale again, as we're seeing. And Moses isn't telling them, like, remember our foundation, right? God will fight for you. You are his people. You are Israel. That's your name, right? God's going to fight on your behalf, okay? And so Moses calls out to the Lord, right? And Lord has him, again, stretch out his hands. The water split, okay? And God prevents, right, all of Pharaoh's army from even, like, reaching the Israelites, which is impressive, right? Kind of confuses them, keeps them from getting them, and allows, again, if you think about it, how long that would have to be to allow over 600,000 people to cross a body of water. Okay? And so he divides the waters. They go on dry ground, right? Which is in its own impressive miracle. All right? And they all make it through. And what? Pharaoh's army goes after. You guys know the story. Waters close back up, destroying the army. Okay? That's what ends up happening. Okay? And what? And at this point, you see what? The Egyptians' army, they're done. Right? It's all over. And if you remember what we talked about last week, Egypt at this time was really like the world's first like superpower. And what? God has decimated them. Right? He has decimated the world's superpower. It's over. Right? Their economy sunk. Their army, more literally, sunk. Right? It's done. Right? It's over. Okay? That's what happens here in this Exodus, okay? And the people see all this. This is on full display to the people, okay? Chapter 15, you have the Song of Moses, right? Where the people sing, rejoice about this, and kind of sing in songs reflecting about what God has done and what he's kind of going to do, right, in the future. And we don't have time to go into all the details of that, but they're rejoicing over it. But then we start to see very quickly, starting in verse 22 of chapter 15 and going through the next couple chapters, right, the reality that Israel is bad and needs change, right? What we saw in chapter 14, where I mentioned there's the vertical problem, right? This becomes even more evident, right, as they continue in the wilderness and they start grumbling, complaining about water and food and all this stuff, right? To the point where in chapter 17, right, it talks about them that they are testing the Lord, right? That's what they're essentially doing. They're testing the Lord. And real quick, like kind of the problem of that, right, is testing in and of itself isn't a bad thing, okay? Like we take tests or do certain things, right? It's not necessarily bad. But what does a test normally indicate, right? Who normally is the one testing the other? It's normally the superior testing the what? Inferior, right? Like students in a classroom, they don't give teachers tests, right? Teachers give students tests as like an evaluate and all that stuff, right? Because they have authority. And so in this situation, when you have like Israel or when we like test God and stuff, what? We are flipping the script to where we are trying to put ourselves in the position of the superior and God in the inferior. That's why testing God is such a big deal. Right? And that's why what they're doing in the wilderness, all this stuff, is such a big deal. Right? It's because they're kind of trying to take that authority from God. Right? So it's a big deal. And again, it's showing that Israel is bad. Right? They are bad. They need change. Okay? And then we see in the second half of chapter 17, we see this battle between the Israelites and the Amalekites. All right? You have the Amalekites come, and they come out and fight against Israel. Okay, and this is that battle, if you guys remember, where like whenever Moses raises his hand and stuff, like they're winning, and then when he lowers it, they're not, and all that, okay? And kind of the point of all that, right, is who is that putting on display when Moses is like raising his hands and stuff, and they're winning and they're not? God, right? It's not Moses. It's not like, oh, that guy's pretty awesome. Whenever he does this, like, that's cool. It's a cool magic trick, right? No, it's like, it's putting God on display, right? And so, ultimately, who's really fighting this battle? God, right? That's what's happening here, okay? And that goes back to the what? The name Israel. God fights for you, right? We see that, again, on display, okay? And this time, it's put on display to the Amalekites, to other nations. Again, it's starting to become more international, okay, this idea. And so that's what we start to see here, okay? And at the end of that interaction, right, God promises to blot out the memory of the Amalekites and all that. And if you zoom ahead later in the Old Testament, you have a guy that had the opportunity to kind of complete this, fulfill that, by the name of Saul, right? King Saul. Does he do it?
No.
Right? Kind of spares some people. So there's the king Agag and all that, which then leads, if you go even further down Israel's history, in the time of Esther, do you guys remember the guy Haman? All right, do you remember his descendant, like what descendant is he of?
Agagite.
Yeah, an Agagite, which is an Amalekite, right? And so you have there, even in like the exile, hundreds of years later, right? The Amalekites, like Haman's trying to almost finish what his ancestors began in Exodus 17, right? And there, just as here in Exodus, what do you have? God fighting for his people, right? And that's what the cool point that you have there, like in Esther with that, right? Is just like in Exodus, what? God still fights for his people. Even when you're in exile, Israel, God is still fighting for you. He's still working to intervene on your behalf. Right, just like he did back in Exodus, he's doing there in Esther. Right, really cool stuff there. All right, chapter 18, you have kind of Moses' interaction with Jethro, his father-in-law. Okay, and kind of the main point of why this is significant, right, is as he talks with Jethro, he declares all of what God has done for Israel, okay, telling Jethro what he did with the Egyptians, all that stuff. And notice Jethro's response, right? Starting like verse 11. What's he say? He says, "Now I know that what? The Lord is greater than all gods." Okay? And in verse 12, Jethro offers offerings and sacrifices to God, right? Because you remember, Israel's purpose, right, is to what? Be a light to the nations, to be a witness to the nations, that point people back to God, right? And this is actually taking place, right? Jethro, who he's a Midianite, right? Not like part of Israel. He's a Midianite. And what? He is learning about the true God. Okay? He's learning about the true God. He's recognizing that Yahweh, Israel's God, is greater than all the gods. Okay? Again, we're starting to see this national, like God getting put on national display to the nations. Okay? And then also the last kind of half of that chapter, right? You see kind of Moses, that whole idea where we talk about like, oh, you need to delegate and stuff like that, which is, yeah, that's true. Delegation's good, I guess. But kind of the point there is what? Israel's becoming a great nation. So much so that Moses can't do it all himself, right? That they have to appoint other leaders to help kind of settle disputes and do all this stuff. He needs help, okay? Which again shows the greatness and how great their nation is becoming. They're becoming big. All right, that's what's happening. All right, so that leads us to our last section of Exodus, all right, which is Israel at Sinai, all right? They make it to Mount Sinai, okay? And what we start to see here, right, as they're here in Mount Sinai, the beginning, chapter 19, okay, what we're going to see in kind of the rest of Exodus is really God making his people into a nation, okay? It's kind of more affirming that, making them into a nation, but at the same time revealing his holy and gracious name, right? Because if you remember, one of our themes of Exodus was the God, like, who reveals his name, okay? And we've seen that he's revealed his, like, redemptive name, right? He redeems his people and all that, and now we're going to see also that he reveals his holiness and graciousness to his people as well, okay? And this is also where we're going to start getting into what we call the Mosaic Covenant, all right? The Mosaic Covenant, which that's like called that way because Moses kind of received it for the people, all right? Mosaic Covenant, all right? And we'll talk more about that, okay? But we need to point out some important things from this chapter as we start getting into the Mosaic Covenant and all that, okay? Notice verses 5 and 6, okay, in chapter 19, first of all. Here we get to see really Israel's purpose as a nation. Okay, in these two verses, we get to see Israel's purpose as a nation. And kind of a cool link, Peter picks this up in 1 Peter to also talk about believers in this way. And kind of, so this somewhat relates to our purpose as well as believers, okay? But notice in these verses, right, in verse 5, he talks about, if you obey my voice, keep my covenant, what's he say? You shall be my what? Treasured possession. All right, you shall be my treasured possession. God will love them as a valuable treasure, right? This, again, emphasizes the vertical relationship that Israel can have with the Lord. He will actually treasure you, right? He will love you, care for you like a treasured possession, okay? But he also talks about not only the vertical, but also the horizontal, right? In verse 6, where he says, what? They shall also be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, okay? What's a priest do? Yeah, mediates between God and man, right? That's kind of the function of a priest. And so kind of people bring people to God. And so Israel is supposed to function this way. That is supposed to be their role to the nations, right? Is to essentially bring people to the Lord, right? They're supposed to be kind of this mediator between God and man, all right? And so they are supposed to have this high relationship with the Lord and then facilitate then other people having the same intimate relationship with God. That's what they're supposed to do as a kingdom of priests, okay? And that's their role, okay? And how they're supposed to do that, how they're going to accomplish that is what? By being a holy nation, all right? That through their actions, through how they live, they are supposed to put God on display in such a way that it draws people to the Lord, right? That points people to the Lord. That when, if you remember, like how they're situated geographically, right, where people pass through all this stuff, they should see that there is something different about this nation. There is something different about the God of this nation, and they should be pointing to that, right, and be a light to those nations by how they act, okay, by being this holy nation, okay? That's what's going on here. So they have a vertical as well as horizontal purpose. Right, to have this relationship with God as a treasured possession, but to also then facilitate other people coming to the knowledge of who this God is as well. Okay? That's really their role. All right? And if they're keeping the covenant, doing these things, that's going to be accomplished. Okay? All right. And so, real quick, before we dive into some of the details, we do need to talk briefly about kind of the Mosaic covenant in general, okay? That's still just, I don't know, you can find a space to write in here. It's not really the next point. All right, just to clarify what this covenant is, this is what is often referred to, like even in the New Testament, as like the law, okay? That's being referred to, it's the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic law, okay? The same thing, okay? And really what this covenant does, okay, and you have to remember, when we talked about at the very beginning, the first class, when we talked about the names for like these five books, where we talk about the Torah, right? Which that term in Hebrew has the idea of teaching or instruction, okay? And really, that's the whole point of the Mosaic Covenant is to teach. It is an instructor, a teacher, right? That's what's going on here, okay? The law, right? The Mosaic Covenant was never meant to save you. Okay, it was never set up as, hey, obey all these things, and that's how you have eternal life with God. It's never how it's supposed to be. Okay, that's not what its goal was. But rather, what its goal was to teach and instruct, right? It was to point, it was to show in a way, right? The law is going to show, like, this is who your God is. This is what he loves. This is kind of what he desires of you. This is what is good. This is what is bad, right? It's going to train you, okay? But ultimately, what it's going to show is that a holy God demands perfect holiness. And it's going to point to this fact that kind of you're going to fail to meet it, okay? But it's also going to point that there's going to come a day where there's going to be a new prophet, right? Like Deuteronomy 18 talks about, that there's going to be a new prophet, a new one, kind of like Moses, who's going to come with a new covenant. And it's that one, that person, who is going to give life. Okay? And so really the law is going to be pointing forward, okay? Pointing outside of itself to say that's where salvation is. Not in me, but in this other person, this other covenant, okay? And I had a professor who gave like the great example, and we even have this example, right? Like exit signs on the door, right? If there's a fire, do you just cling to the exit sign and say, this is going to save me? No. What's the exit sign there for? To point you into the way of safety, right? Exit that way because that's where you're going to be safe. Not cling to me, you're going to be fine, right? And then the same way, the Mosaic Covenant, it was never meant to save you. Right? It was meant to point you to that which does save you. Okay? That's really its point. And so we often have this thought that, oh, people of the Old Testament, if they obeyed the law, like, that's how they were saved. No. Right? That's not how they were saved. As we talked about with Abraham, it's always been by faith. Okay? But the Mosaic Covenant, its function, right, is to point in that direction. But it's also supposed to teach you. It's supposed to teach you about God. It's supposed to teach you about how he desires you to live, all these things. Okay? That's really what it's about. Okay? That's what the Mosaic Covenant's about. And so understood in this way, right? We have to understand that each of these laws are meant to teach and instruct us. Okay? And so even though we're no longer under the law, like Romans 7 talks about, we don't like obey all these laws, all the applications of it. A lot of the underlying principles that are there are still kind of applicable, right? They're still applicable and we can learn from them. We can learn more about who God is, what he desires from the law. So it's not just, oh, I can cut these pages out of my Bible, right? It's no, they still are helpful. They still are instructive as a teacher. Okay. All right. Let's see what time is it. All right, we got 15 minutes. We can do it. All right, so 10 Commandments. Only half the book. It's fine. It'll go quick. Maybe. All right, so 10 Commandments. All right, probably one of the most famous sections of Scripture. All right, and so we see these laws, and really they're kind of a summary of like the entire law, right? That's kind of what it is, right? Where a lot of people view a lot of the more specific laws as kind of fleshing out of the 10 Commandments, right? It can normally be traced back to one of those 10 Commandments. And so, again, we have to remember these communicate or teach something. And a lot of people also point that they can kind of actually point back to creation and some of the things established there and built off of that. Okay. And so, oh, I don't have these. All right. So the first command, right, which is to what? Not have other gods before the Lord. Okay. Which, again, that makes sense if you go back to creation, because what? He established in creation, I'm the one true God. There is no other like me. I am the only one. Okay? So we're not supposed to have gods above him. Second command, what's that one? You should not do what? Make a carved image or anything like that. And so that's kind of the flip side of that first one, where not only should there be nothing above God, but you should not bring God down at all. You should not bring God down to your level. As soon as you start to make idols or images, you're what? Like diminishing who God is. Okay? Which that's not good, because again, remember in creation, the creator is separate from the creation, right? There's a distinction that needs to be there. Third commandment is what? Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, all right? Remember, like, the idea of a name has to also do with, like, your character, who you are, okay? So this can involve, like, oath statements, okay? But it also has, like, this idea of kind of living consistently with God's character. Okay, live consistently with God's character. And we see where God started to reveal himself, Genesis 1, right? Fourth command has to do with the what? Sabbath, all right? Sabbath day, which hopefully that's pretty easy to make the connection back to creation. What day of creation? Seventh day. All right, good. And so, again, you need to kind of abide in God's agenda, right? He is kind of established, I work 6 days, I rested, you're supposed to do the same thing, right? And that's so significant if you think about it. If a whole nation worked 6 days and then everything shut down the seventh, wouldn't that stand out? And nations would kind of ask, like, well, why do you do that? And what's their response? Well, let me tell you what happened in creation, right? Let me tell you what happened at the beginning. Okay, that's why. Okay, so again, it's teaching, it's instructing. All right, fifth command. Honor your father and mother. Parents love it. There you go. All right. And so this kind of related to this idea, kind of a lot of people connected with the first command of kind of honoring, respecting God. And by showing that in order, if you learn to honor and respect earthly authority, you're going to learn to what? Honor divine authority. Right. That's what's going to kind of happen. Okay. Sixth command, murder. Yeah, you shall not murder, okay? Which, kind of, when did death start? Fall, right? Death started the fall, okay? And so really this is showing Israel is an anti-fall nation, right? They preserve life, not take it. And probably goes back to also man being created in the image of God, okay? Seventh command, adultery, all right? Don't commit adultery, which emphasizes kind of holiness and purity, okay? That they are a nation that is pro-holiness, right? Eighth command, don't steal, okay? People point out, when did Adam take something that wasn't his? Yeah, the fall, right? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? That wasn't a good thing. All right. Let's see. Number nine. Yeah, don't bear false witness. Don't pervert justice, right? Which we saw, like, Adam and Eve kind of blaming other people and different things, okay? And really, people suggest, like, the commands 6 through 9, right? The murder, adultery, steal, bearing false witness. Those all kind of relate to the idea of that's, like, how you don't take God's name in vain, right? That's how you live according to God's character. This is kind of fleshing that out as well, okay? And then what's the 10th and last command? Don't covet, okay? The same word is used as Eve's desire for the tree in Genesis 3. And so again, it's don't do what happened or is associated with the fall. Be that anti-fall nation, right? Kind of a thing, okay? Be content with what God has given you, okay? Be content with God's agenda, okay? All right. And so really, this is the message of Israel, right? Like through these Ten Commandments, like one person described it as, we are an anti-fall nation. We are a nation that points back to creation, and we want to live out what God has established in creation. Okay, that's really what Israel is putting on display through living out the Ten Commandments, that they are an anti-fall nation. They're a nation that points back to creation, and we want to live out what God has established in creation. Okay, that's what Israel is doing in these Ten Commandments. All right. All right. And so then you have kind of these other laws that we don't have time to go specifically through, okay? But again, a lot of these are kind of fleshing out the Ten Commandments, all right? Of like how these Ten Commandments then look in everyday life in certain situations and all of that, okay? And we see then in chapter 24, the covenant confirmed, all right? The covenant confirmed, the people are sprinkled with blood of the covenant, essentially showing like the covenant is established, which on the one hand, that means they can have this communion with God. But on the other hand, if they fail to live up to this covenant, what? They should be like these animals, right? We talked about covenants before. That's kind of the point. They should be like these animals, which means they deserve what?
Death.
Okay. That's what's being established there in chapter 24. Okay. We then have in chapters 25 through the first part of 31, we have instructions for building the tabernacle, okay? As we talked about before, as I mentioned, that Israel, by living out, like, the law, they're going to put on display that, hey, this is how we kind of go back to creation, all this stuff. This is further confirmed by the tabernacle, all right? Kind of the whole point of the tabernacle is to, again, put on display that, what? We can go back to creation. We can go back to Eden, right? Like if you read through some of the tabernacle imagery as well as eventually the temple later on, there's a lot of kind of images and allusions back to creation, back to Eden, which is purposeful, right? Because you have God dwelling there. This is where he dwells with man in a sense, right? In the tabernacle. And it's essentially putting on display the nations around him, hey, there's a way back, right? There's a way back. Eden is not lost. We have a way back to creation. And the tabernacle is evidence of that. Right? God dwelling with man. Right? And even though there is a separation right now, right? Because not everyone can just kind of waltz into the tabernacle, right? But we are heading back to there will be the day where God will dwell with man fully, just like it was back in Eden. Okay? And that's really the point of the tabernacle. Right? That's why it's there. Okay, is to put that on display. Okay, we also have instructions for the Sabbath. All right, kind of clarifying that a little bit more. But notice specifically at the end of chapter 31 there, after the Lord finishes speaking with Moses, he gives him what? In verse 18 there. He gives him two tablets, right? Two tablets of the covenant. And a lot of times we kind of think like, God wrote like half on one, then ran out of room, kind of went over on the other. It's like, no, like they're copies of the same thing, right? They're two copies of the covenant, essentially one for each party, right? Essentially showing, hey, this is the covenant. And we both have evidence that this is what is we've agreed to, essentially, okay? We have this relationship. We have this covenant relationship. But then we have in chapter 32 kind of a hiccup in all this. And something, if you remember what we've said about Israel all along, shouldn't completely surprise us. We have the golden calf incident, right? Where Moses takes a while on the mountain. People are kind of like, he's taking a while. We should build an idol. They're like, what? That's not good. All right. So they build an idol, build this golden calf, and they start kind of worshiping, offering offerings and different things, rising up and playing, which is kind of euphemism for stuff. You can figure that out. Not good stuff. And so essentially, right, they're breaking like a lot of the Ten Commandments, right, by what they're doing. And how many do you have to break to deserve death? One, right? So they're going over the top. They're extra credit there in a bad way. All right? And so what? The Lord tells Moses, you need to get down there. They're doing all this, and I'm going to, like, kill them, right? I'm going to kill them. And what happens? Moses intervenes, right? Moses intervenes, and you see here God establishing the role of a mediator, right? God establishing the role of a mediator. That's what's happening here, okay? Like, how are you going to get right with God when you are so in the wrong? You need a mediator, okay? And we see this position is going to continue throughout Israel's history till it culminates in, once again, who? Christ, right? Which 1 Timothy talks about. He is, there is one mediator between God and man, our Lord Jesus Christ, right? 1 Timothy 2. Okay? So God relents. He doesn't kill them quite yet, right? Moses goes down the mountain. He sees all that's going on. And what's Moses do? Breaks the tablets, right? Breaks the tablets. And that kind of symbolizes and shows what? The relationship's over. Covenant's done. You guys messed it up. The relationship is done. You all deserve death. Right? That's what it is. And we see then the Lord kind of instructs Moses to get some of the Levites together and essentially tells them, go through the camp and start executing them. Right? Executing all those who are part of this. And they kill, it says, 3,000 people that day. Right? That's significant. A lot of people. Okay? And we see the next day, at the end of chapter 32, Moses again goes before the Lord to try to intervene, be this mediator for the people. And it was in verse 32, he says, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written, right? Essentially, let me die instead of these people. And does God take that kind of that mediation? Does he accept that offer? Does Moses die right there? No, right? So does he accept it?
No,
right? Which shows what? That Moses isn't the true mediator, right? He's not the ultimate mediator, which again leads us and points us, sets the stage for who? Jesus, right? Down the road. There is going to be one that can take all of that on himself and die the death we deserve, right? But now you have here, at the end of chapter 32, right, this reality of what? The people have failed, right? They failed, but also their who? Their mediator has failed. So what are they left to depend on to, like, not die? God, right? That's it. There's no other option, right? It's just hopefully God is gracious and merciful to us, okay? And we see in chapter 33 this question of, is God going to continue with Israel? Is he going to continue with Israel? Notice in verse 3 of chapter 33, he tells Moses, I tell him, go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but what? I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way. Okay? Essentially, he tells them, I will be merciful. You can still go up to the land, but I'm not going with you. Right? I can't, else I'm going to kill all you. Right? It's not going to be good. But what? He's showing mercy still, right? Not giving them what they deserve. That's mercy, okay? And he's allowing them to continue to go forward, okay? But again, you have Moses plead. He intercedes, saying, God, we need you with us, right? That's, again, the whole point of Israel. You are with us. You're a God that fights for us. Without you, we are, like, dead. It's not going to work. We need you to go with us, okay? And so then you have, in verse 14, what? God say, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. All right? All right. I'll go with you. Okay, I will go with you. And Moses kind of wants that assurance, right? That God will actually go. And he asks him, reveal, like, please show me your glory, right? And God's kind of like, you can't really handle my glory. But he kind of gives in and lets him see anyways. To, again, he doesn't have to, right? But he does to give that assurance to Moses, okay? And that leads into Exodus 34, which in verses 6 and 7 are some very important verses throughout all of Scripture, right? Where God reveals really like his name, like who he is, right? If you want to understand like who is Yahweh, like what is he about? What is like Yahweh? How do you describe him in any sense, right? You have here the Lord declaring about himself in verse 6. He's the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. All right. And there's so much in there I wish we had time to unpack, but we don't. All right. But really, these verses become so foundational for Israel. If you read throughout the rest of the Old Testament, they're going to keep quoting back these verses, especially with the emphasis on that like steadfast love, that grace that God has given for his people. This is foundational, right? To the point where, because if you remember, the nation, the only reason they don't die is because what? Because God is gracious to them. And if you read like further Psalms that touch on like this passage, that's kind of their point, is saying like our nation should have ended, but God was gracious to us. And I understand that, right? But these, again, verses are so foundational to the rest of Scripture, so important, okay, that they'll be repeated over and over again. You even have like in, real quick, in the book of like Jonah, right, where God doesn't destroy Nineveh. And what's Jonah say? He's like, I knew you were a God who was gracious and loving. You know, like he quotes these verses, right? Because he's like, oh, I knew that was you, right? And that's like what's going on. These are so important, right, of what's going on, okay? So God will continue with them, right? Sorry, yeah, reveals his name, ties in the theme again. All right, and then the covenant is renewed at the end of chapter 34, right? Makes two new tablets. Essentially, the covenant's back on, right? They're like starting over. The relationship is renewed. It's restored. Almost kind of like nothing happened. And that's God's grace, his mercy, his forgiveness in full effect there. Okay? We also see the Sabbath reinstituted, right? Meaning that God is going to, it's showing that God is going to resume to use Israel, all right, to accomplish his agenda to get people back to creation. Okay, and then chapters 35 to 40, like throughout, we see the actual construction of the tabernacle, okay, which again, as we talked about before, points people back to Eden, okay, pointing back, this is the way back to original creation, this is actually being made now, and then if you look at the end of chapter 40, verses 34 to 38, with how the book wraps up, right, when the construction's all done, what happens? The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, right? This shows that God didn't abandon his people. He stayed with them, right? He stayed with them. But notice also that as the glory of the Lord filled the temple, no one could stand to like minister there. No one could stand there, right? Not even Moses, okay? And what we start to see, the question becomes, right? You have now this holy God who has agreed to go with these people, to dwell amongst these people. But what do we know about these people? They're what? They're sinful. They're wicked. And so how do you bridge this gap between how can you have a holy God dwell with a sinful people? And you have the answer in what? Leviticus. Leviticus. All right? That's what Leviticus is going to answer, is how do you have a holy God dwell with a sinful people? How can that coexist? Leviticus is going to be that answer. And we'll get to that next week.